Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, the DVD gurus are back, having braved the elements this morning. It's a good day to talk about movies because a lot of folks still are housebound and not at the office today. It's been 3 days since the Oscars, not long enough that we can't revisit this idea of the Best Picture Award. Today, our theme is films that won Oscars and maybe shouldn't have, and those films that didn't win and maybe should have. So on the agenda this morning are Citizen Kane, Around the World in 80 Days, Crash, and Forrest Gump, and a whole bunch more. The DVD gurus are Mitch Bryan. He's a screenwriter, UMKC film prof, and writer for 435 South. Mitch, good to have you.
Good to see
you. Thanks for venturing in today. And a film critic, Jason Heck, joins us once again. How are you, Haas?
My back hurts.
Yeah, I know your back hurts. All the shoveling. My arms are sore. What's the music we just listened to here?
That was Jerry Goldsmith's theme for Patton.
Ah.
Tin Hut.
Good thing to begin the show.
Yeah.
Tin Hut, yeah. So the motivation for today's show is what, Mitch?
We were talking about the Oscars last week and who was going to win and who wasn't, and we started looking back over the history of the Academy Awards, and it begins to emerge this really strange pattern, which are there are these movies that are sometimes absolutely forgotten that won Best Picture, and these other movies that have become classics that were snubbed.
Win.
Yeah. And how is it that happens, you know, and especially now that the Oscars have become this huge, gigantic operation that reaches arguably a billion people on television and all this sort of attention is focused on them. How did we get there when this thing started out as a group of friends who got together at a restaurant and celebrated the movies that they made the past year and congratulated each other and themselves, and then, you know, at that point went back to the studios to continue making more films. Mm-hmm. And now it's become this institution. It's become as gigantic and corporatized as many of the movies themselves have become.
Jason, what do you make of this evolution we're talking about here?
Well, for me, this show began when Mitch and I were talking about Braveheart, and that movie to me is just I think it's a terrible, terrible choice.
And it won Best Picture. Yeah.
And it won Best Picture. And we started looking at, you know, why would a movie like that win? And so we sort of started looking at patterns and politics and how movies are shaped by everything from currently there's a lot of advertising and campaigning, but how it's sort of backroom deals and arm twisting from people like David O. Selznick. It started to turn into something that merited quite a lot of look, especially when we started looking at some movies that had won that were what Mitch and I deemed aggressively unworthy.
Is there one film that is sort of the iconic example of this?
Absolutely, and I'm going to be talking about it. It's a 1952 picture called The Greatest Show on Earth,
mm-hmm.
and it is I've watched it twice recently, and it is so wretched that it staggers me that this film pulled and yet I know exactly why it did. I know all, you know, and Mitch will tell you exactly the reasons too. Movies that won, it's often not their own merits. It's because of what's up against them. And so you'll pick this movie, say, because you don't want to vote for another movie.
It's sort of also the cultural and political sort of trends
going on
at the time that sort of lead to all that.
Mitch,
right?
And I were, you know, every year gets the best picture it deserves.
Mm-hmm.
So every best picture is part and parcel of its time. So that's why something like Rocky will win in 77 or 76 when it's up against four of honestly the strongest class of Best Picture nominees in history.
Really?
So yeah.
What were those films?
The Network,
yeah.
Taxi Driver,
mm-hmm.
All the President's Men.
Wow.
And Bound for Glory, which is sort of overlooked, but it's this a terrific biopic. But you know, you have basically the greatest satire of the media ever made. You have the greatest journalism film ever made.
Yeah.
You have the greatest
favorite of all time.
I know you love it. And you have the greatest portrait ever of a human being as a ticking time bomb in Taxi Driver. And Rocky, which is a film with a lot of merit, beats this incredible crowd. So really, it's time and place matters.
It speaks to – Rocky was a very popular movie, made lots of money. People were thrilled. They loved it. In fact, it's one of those movies where most people can't even tell you who won the fight. The movie was mm-hmm. so overwhelmingly popular in their imagination that, you know, they forget mm-hmm. that Rocky didn't win. But I think that if you look back at something like 1945 when Going My Way won the Best Picture, it was a light romantic comedy with Bing Crosby about a young priest that comes to a community and works with an older priest, and they sing some songs, and he gets the tough kids in the neighborhood to be in the choir, and what's the line, Jason?
Bing advises a kid who's into drinking. He says, "You know what, son? Stop bending your elbow and start bending your knee."
So here's this movie with Bing's the number one box office star. This movie is the number one box office hit. It comes out at a time when we're coming out of the Second World War, and people probably want to feel good.
Are hungry,
you know, they
for
need
feeling
good. Something
yeah.
to make them feel good, and they want to believe that all you got to do is put yourself into the hands of a priest, and everything will be good.
So, what possible chance did Double Indemnity have?
Right, or Gaslight.
right. Yeah. Right.
but then on the other hand, there was, and not a particularly good movie. I'm not going to defend it. But there was a picture called Wilson, which was a biography of a president. In this case, Woodrow Wilson.
In 1945,
mm-hmm. could have been the prestige winner. You know, but people.
People weren't going there.
They wanted the entertainment more than they wanted the lecture. And maybe that's what happened with Argo and Lincoln. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lincoln's a better movie than Argo, I think.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
I think so.
Argo is a very competently made, very suspenseful thriller. Lincoln is a much better crafted film, and it's better in pretty much every way.
It demands more of the audience, that's for sure.
People say it was too talky.
Well, it's Lincoln. I mean, you know, there's going to be some speechifying. Yeah, mm-hmm. People who went in there expecting, you know, Lincoln walking through, you know, behind the scenes in Antietam, we're not going to – I mean, the movie's not going to be an action picture. Lincoln is all about eloquence and his words and his extraordinary speeches. So that's going to be a big part of the movie.
So your sense then, if you're both saying, and many others have said too, that Lincoln was the better made film, so why does Argo win?
Oh.
I mean, is it Spielberg? I mean
– No, that's easy. And Mitchell probably who is better in tune with filmmaking culture in Los Angeles will tell you this, but you had the groundswell of support for Argo during the award season, which starts to turn some heads,
mm-hmm.
right? It's sort of like when you hear that your candidate's not winning, you're probably not going to go to the polls.
Right.
Well, Argo starts winning all these other awards, I think SAG Awards and Directors Guild and Golden Globes. And so people start kind of giving it that look. Then you have Ben Affleck being snubbed for director. So you have some Academy members who start putting it there. And then, of course, the big one, Hollywood is the hero in this movie. They make a fake movie to rescue people, and Oscar has kind of a thing for being self-congratulatory and patting itself on the back. Mm. So when you have all these, you know, you have Arkin and Goodman as these, you know, jaded movie execs who help get these six hostages out, we're going to kind of forget that it was mostly Canada who made that
happen.
Well,
and Alan Arkin's character is a complete fiction. He didn't exist. It was just John Chambers, the makeup guy.
But, you know, that was – Hollywood saved lives. Hollywood was the hero.
But still, there has been sort of something of a trend, at least from my standpoint in Hollywood, of the Academy going for these prestige films that make the industry – that seem to elevate the industry to one degree or another.
In many cases.
And Lincoln seemed to have done that to me – In a very big way.
Absolutely. And there were also, you know, the smaller independent films. Now, granted, Fox Searchlight got behind Beast of the Southern Wild, but this has been a pattern over the last decade where once the studios kind of put the small boutique-y companies out of business, they would then go out and try to make one or two prestige movies a year so that they can feel good about it. Because prior to that, they were just piggybacking off of the independents. So the Weinstein Company, prior to that being Miramax, you know, would make these prestige movies, and Hollywood would feel completely outclassed because these independent producers were coming in there and making the prestige movie. So there's a lot of weird ego stuff, and I guess this all comes back to this idea of maybe – if this was still just a little party where everybody got together in Hollywood and congratulated themselves and each other, that would be one thing. You know, now that it's become this gargantuan media event, it seems kind of disproportionate, you know. And that's why even with the choice of hosts, you know, they get these TV hosts to come in and do the show. And, you know, truthfully, I'd be quite happy if Hugh Jackman did it and if movie stars did it. Remember when David Niven, you know?
Yeah.
Or
Bob
even
Hope did it for, what, 20 years?
Past him, right?
Yeah.
When David Niven
hosted it. That's right.
That's
exactly right. And so maybe it needs to be, instead of trying to make it more crass and bigger and more obnoxious, maybe the strategy should just be to, like, take it down a few notches and –
Nothing terribly wrong with the Golden Globes where everybody's in a smaller venue getting a little bit tipsy on pricey champagne. And, yeah, a smaller might very well be better. I could have done without the production numbers this year. I mean, when they trotted out the musical stuff, I'm done with musical production numbers. When they trotted out
– Streisand?
even. And how did Marvin Hamlish rate that?
Well,
he's your big finish. He's your big finish.
They didn't mention Andy Griffith in the memorial.
I thought about you.
And I was a little upset about that.
The NYT had an article about how hard people campaign to get their friends into the in memoriam thing. That's why you have like a publicity agent who will show up, but a well-known actor won't. Like Harry Morgan didn't show up in there because Harry Morgan was in the Oxbow incident and had a pretty good career in film before he ended up on Dragnet and in MASH. And the Academy's justification was, well, his primary fame was on television.
Oh,
but they're still putting in like a guy, a publicity agent who had some powerful friends.
But then they're going to have a TV guy host the show.
Right.
I mean, it's just it's constantly contradictory.
All over the place. Okay. Well, again, our theme today are films that failed to win the Best Picture Academy Award that maybe should have won it, and which film that won the Best Picture Oscar that maybe didn't deserve it. Your recommendations, your nominations, always welcome here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up to date at kcur.org, or you can tweet us at kcur up to date. Well, let's start with Jason here. Let's go to 1941.
Yeah.
The year that was.
The year that was. So America on the verge of entering the greatest war in global history.
That's right.
We had an interesting race in 41. We had the films that mattered were included Here Comes Mr. Jordan, The Little Foxes, The Maltese Falcon, arguably one of the greatest noirs ever, and Sergeant York, as well as Alfred Hitchcock's Suspicion. The film that won was from a man that Orson Welles actually referred to as the master, a guy named John Ford, who is a quintessentially American filmmaker, and he made this thing called How Green Was My Valley, and it's
what? I don't recall that one.
Yeah, well, it is not in every film school. It's this sort of multi-generational saga about a farming family in Wales and eking out this living. And you know, it is of the people and it is in the earth. And, you know, you can practically smell fresh turned earth and manure in this movie.
It's Grapes of Wrath, sounds like, a little bit.
Not an unfair comparison. And it was tailor-made, basically, for Oscar. I'll tell you what, why don't we hear a clip now from the film that probably should have won that year?
Okay.
Please, Susan, from now on everything will be exactly the way you want it to be. Not the way I think you want it, but your way. I mustn't go. You can't do this to me.
I see. It's you that this is being done to. It's not me at all. Not what it means to me. I can't do this to you. Oh, yes, I can.
And that film was?
Citizen Kane, which tops many, many lists as the greatest film of all time. It is a film that changed everything.
And just for the record, it did not win Picture Oscar.
No, yeah. It did not win. How Green Was My Valley won. Kane was nominated for 9 Oscars, but only won Best Original Screenplay for Herman Mankiewicz, who shared the award with Welles.
And so the question is why?
Well, here's why. Because it was a thinly veiled attack on William Randolph Hearst, who owned a lot of newspapers. And basically what happened was it was lucky to be nominated. You had this brash upstart. He was 25 up against establishment Hollywood. And he made a movie that really did change everything, whether it was Greg Toland's cinematography or Robert Wise's incredibly sharp editing. It was nominated for 9. So Hollywood kind of – it was one of those welcome to the table, young man. We're happy you're here, but don't expect any more. And it was so anti-establishment that there was no possible way it could have won. Hearst would have seen to that.
Well, Hearst tried to have it destroyed. I mean, Hearst offered to pay the studio to burn the negative.
Really?
I mean, he was not happy about
this. Wonder if members of the Academy from back then sort of looked back on their votes that year and thought, yeah, we sort of blew it.
Or given their age, they probably thought, yeah, we kept our jobs. We're still going to parties at San Simeon and things are going to be okay. You know, here's the thing. How Green Was My Valley is a perfectly fine film. It's a film that has it can hold its head high among a lot of winners, frankly, from back then. There's nothing terribly wrong with it. It's just simply kind of comparing Mozart and Salieri, you know. One is a fine example. One is transcendent. One is bigger than anything that's come before and changes everything that will follow. But this is a perfect example of politics ensuring that, you know, this movie was suppressed in theaters. Wells saw, you know, watch theaters pull it when Hearst would run certain, you know, we won't run your theater chains advertising if you carry Citizen Kane, wow. if you put this.
Wow.
So this is a perfect example of politics ensuring that, but what should far and away be the winner gets a sort of little consolation prize.
I bet if you asked 100 Americans who know anything about film, you know, did Citizen Kane win the Best Picture Award in 1941, they'd all say, oh, sure it did.
Absolutely.
And here, come to find out,
How Green Was My Valley. And again, How Green Was My Valley is not a lousy movie. It's not an unworthy winner. It's just not Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
You know, it's an Olympic gold athlete up against Superman.
Interesting. Eric writes us on Twitter, at KCUR, up to date. Are mediocrity and least offensive the way of the Oscar Best Picture winner these days?
Does seem to be the case.
Yeah. You hear that a lot.
Yeah. But, you know, mediocrity and less offensive seems to be driving Hollywood these days.
You know?
So, again, back to this notion of maybe they get the Oscars they deserve. You know, this is where our culture is right now in terms of movie making.
Films that failed to win the Best Picture Oscar that should have won it and films that won it that didn't deserve it. That's our topic today. 816-235-2888 for your nominations. Let's go to Michael from Overland Park. Michael, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess my issue I guess I want to bring up, I think, was in 2005 whenever Crash ended up kind of coming up late and I think, you know, beating Brokeback Mountain, which everyone thought was a favorite. Which I always thought was interesting because someone friend pointed out to me, has any film kind of really faded quicker than Crash? Because I only saw it once and I've never had a desire to ever see it again.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be talking about it a little later today. And I watched it. I took the hit and I watched it again just for you, Michael.
And I appreciate it.
Yeah. You should. You owe me a beer or something.
And to answer his question, has any film faded as quickly as Crash?
It's in the faded list. Let's just say that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Great point, Michael. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Let's go to Dennis from Kansas City, Missouri. Dennis, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Can anyone answer what was Cavalcade? Cavalcade won in like 1934, and I have no idea what that movie is. Go ahead.
I think Cavalcade was a big prestige musical, which did very well back in the 30s. But, yeah, it beat A Farewell to Arms, 42nd Street. I'm a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, which is amazingly good.
Oy!
And it beat some other big musicals, though. 42nd Street, State Fair. You know, that's the kind of stuff they nominated back then, as well as Little Women, a movie that I continue to be disappointed every time I never see midgets.
My all-time, the one I called in about was Space Odyssey, which to me is, like, still pretty disturbing to watch.
Yeah.
and on Blu-ray, it is almost unbearable. So those are my picks, and Cavalcade has always mystified me. I've looked at that on the list, and I go, never seen it.
You know,
even know who's in it.
They are of their time. You know, not a lot of us have seen Sunrise either, but that's what started it all off, along with Wings. So, you know, they lose relevance as they age for a real long time.
But Sunrise is one of the ten great films ever made, though.
Right. Lamentably, no one really has seen it.
All right.
Yeah, and then the other thing that won that year in 1968 was Oliver. And I don't know what was else was nominated that year, but Space Odyssey to me is like the one that everybody still sees, one that everybody clamored to get on Blu-ray quickly, you know. And okay, that's all I have to say.
Hey, thanks for the call, Dennis.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, 1968, Mitch and I were laughing about this because in the 1960s, every year you had sort of all these groundbreaking pictures and one big musical that would get in there, that a big studio would kind of bully its way in. So things like Oliver and Funny Girl and stuff get nominated alongside The Lion in Winter and all these other great pictures. It's just kind of one big, beefy, you know, musical just powers its way in there and generally doesn't do much except when it surprises you like Oliver does.
The DVD gurus are in the house, Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. And Mitch Bryan's up next with the year 1956. And Mitch, what happened that year?
What did happen?
Well, this is an interesting list because that year it was the Ten Commandments, The King and I, Giant, Friendly Persuasion, and the winner was Around the World in 80 Days. Now, Around the World in 80 Days is a really interesting case study for a variety of reasons. First, it was produced by this showman extraordinaire named Mike Todd, who had come up through live theater and eventually got involved with the Cinerama process, which was this cumbersome process where they would use three cameras that would shoot at the same time, and then this image would be exhibited on this gigantic screen. We had one of the great Cinerama screens here at the Empire Theater in Kansas City.
He once married Elizabeth Taylor, right?
And he would go on to win the Best Picture for the only movie he would ever make.
Wow.
And marry Elizabeth Taylor in the same year. It was a good year for Mike Todd. Yeah. But and thirdly, make that film in a format that after he moved away from Cinerama, he invented his own version of Cinerama, which he would say everything comes out of one hole versus having three cameras, and it was called Todd AO Vision. And so part of the reason that Around the World in 80 Days is at least memorable is because it was the big showpiece for this new technology, this new type of movie making. And so the movie, on the other hand, is very stiff and stodgy. It's like this dinosaur because the camera was so gigantic, and they decided that they would shoot simultaneously 24 frames per second, which is normal movie projection speed, and also shoot it at 30 frames per second. So everywhere they went, they had these two gigantic cameras, large format cameras, shooting the scene at the same time. And there are actually kind of two versions of the film, although I guess the 30 frame per second thing is fading in some vault somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is stiff. It's conventional. It's very simple. But it's a big travelogue. And then the final thing that makes it interesting is he came up with this idea of the cameo role. And that was the role that you would get a big star to come in and they would do one scene, and it would be, as he described it, a little jewel-like addition to the movie. That's why we're calling it a cameo. I mean, he was the guy who came up with the names for everything. He's a showman like William Castle, right?
Yeah.
So you watch the movie now, and yeah, Shirley MacLaine is adorable in it. And Quentin Floss, who is one of the
Shirley MacLaine is in this film.
Yeah, she plays the Indian princess. I think it was her first movie.
My goodness.
And then there's a Mexican comedian named Quentin Floss, who's sort of the Mexican Charlie Chaplin, and he's a great physical comedian. And David Niven is, you know, got charm to burn, but the movie just kind of goes from one travelogue set piece to the next, populated by these strange additions to the film.
Yeah. What's the clip we're going
to
hear here?
So here are a couple of cameos. He managed to get Noel Coward and John Gielgud. And what he did is he went to John Gielgud and said, will you be in my movie? And Gielgud's like, why would I want to be in your movie? He said, because I got Noel Coward. It's like, oh, okay. So here we go. They got them together and they did a scene together.
Here we go.
When I first placed you with Mr. Fogg a fortnight ago, I warned you that he was an eccentric.
An eccentric, Mr. Hesketh Baggett? The man's a tyrant. A cold-hearted, implacable fiend.
Must I remind you, Foster, that you are speaking of a member of the Reform Club?
I don't care if he's a member of the Worshipful Company of Fishmongers. The man's mad.
Actually, excessive sanity is not a necessary qualification for that particular institution.
Believe me, sir, he's not human. Do you know how many valets he's had during the last 6 months?
Well, certainly I do. I've supplied him with five of them myself.
And are you aware that he tortured them with a refinement of cruelty which would have put Torquemada and the entire Spanish Inquisition to shame? He's as cold and methodical as those two watches he carries about with him.
Now, come, Foster. You are abandoning yourself to rhetoric. Kindly remember that you have been rigorously trained as a gentleman's gentleman.
A gentleman's gentleman is one thing, sir. A whimpering, cringing slave is another.
Your Best Picture winner for 1956, ladies and gentlemen.
Man, no kidding. Around the World in 80 Days. Okay, well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our survey of films that failed to win the Best Picture Oscar that should have won it, and films that won it that shouldn't have won it. Your recommendations, welcome. 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org. And Mitch Bryan, what music is this?
This is from Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down.
Okay. Let's take a break. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. looking back. What's that music from?
That's from another Best Foreign Film winner, The Battle of Algiers.
Ah, okay. Well, if you missed yesterday's conversation about the snow or newly developing healthcare information apps, that conversation about the snow is still good today. You can find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech is one of the most iconic moments of the civil rights movement, and it happened during the 63 March on Washington. We'll talk about that march and how it affected the movement's power. This hour, we're talking about the Best Picture Oscar and which films failed to win it that should have and which films did win it that shouldn't have. Again, your nominations welcome, 816-235-2888, and our email address, update@kcur.org. Let's go to Aaron from Olathe. Aaron, good morning.
Hi there.
Hi, Aaron.
My pick for a film that won the Best Oscar, and I don't believe it should have, and I don't even remember what it was up against, was Titanic, and I know that's really unpopular. And I was, when it came out, I was like target demographic, early 20s, and I love all the actors that were in it, but I didn't think it was even close to their best roles that they've had since or before. I just thought it was a big bombastic.
That's interesting.
It was an awesome movie for the theater, don't get me wrong. I just didn't think it was even close to should have won Best Picture for the year that it was nominated.
You'll notice it won no acting awards. This is a movie that is sort of like when The Lord of the Rings, the Return of the King won. It's basically a thank you for making us all these billions of dollars, and we're going to reward you with a lot of prestige and stuff. But you'll notice that all the awards that counted that year went to other people. Kim Basinger got Best Actress for L.A., Best Supporting Actress. L.A. Confidential is, I think, what probably should have won that year, but it was also up against As Good As It Gets, The Full Monty, and Good Will Hunting. So it was almost all technical stuff. And even cinematographers like Russell Carpenter won Best Cinematography. That's basically writing Cameron's coattails all the way to your little gold reward. So that happens once in a while when the Academy basically wants to say thank you. Peter Jackson got it in 03. Cameron got it.
And it's also a technological landmark. And there is this trend of these movies like Around the World in 80 Days that do something technological that movies have never done before.
Yeah.
And they,
that's why Avatar got nominated, I guess.
That's why The Towering Inferno was nominated for Best Picture 1 year.
Right. They made O.J. act. Yeah.
I don't disagree with Aaron at all. But, boy, those scenes in the water just make you cold. Just even thinking about
it
today.
Technically, it is a tour de force. It's an astonishing creation. And, you know, as he spent north of $200 million and everybody thought it would just sink as quickly as the ship, and it shocked everyone. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's an amazing movie, but it's not a great one.
Aaron, thank you. Let's go to John from Kansas City, Missouri. John, good morning. You there, John? He was going to say The Color Purple was completely underrated. Should have done better.
I don't love The Color Purple, but I don't think it deserved to go 0 for 12 at the Oscars. That was
0 for 12.
Yeah, that was before people took Spielberg seriously. And here he was making a very serious film, I think. And he wanted to sort of say, look, I've made all this money and I'm known for adventure and fantasy and monsters and all this other stuff, but I can do this. And he tried it again with Empire of the Sun. And he finally, nobody could stop Schindler's List. I mean, the Academy would. The Oscars would never have been taken seriously again.
It's a very, very good movie.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. But they had no possible other way they could have gone that year.
Yeah. Again, our phone number here for your recommendations for films that failed to win the Best Picture Academy that should have, and the films that won it that shouldn't have, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's move on here, Jason Heck, to the year 1952. You want to talk about The Greatest Show on Earth.
I don't want to talk about The Greatest Show on Earth. But it's a great movie to watch when you're homeboned in the snow. Pretty incredible.
I started laughing right away. Yeah.
Anyway, this is the quintessential example that people will hold up when they say that the Oscars are more about politics than merit. Because what happened was, what should have won is a little film called High Noon, an unbelievably timely parable about the dangers of McCarthyite anti-communism. And it is an extraordinarily – it's a really, really good film. But that was its undoing. It was written by Carl Foreman, who was firmly on the blacklist. It was at the time, red baiting was so bad in Hollywood that even Gary Cooper, who was an incredibly staunch anti-communist – I mean, this was Sergeant York. This was Lou Gehrig, who stepped up to defend Carl Foreman, was slurred, you know, and tarred, and he had to back off of his support for Foreman and thus ended up winning Best Actor that year. Okay, what did win? Well, The greatest show on earth is from Mr. Spectacle himself, Cecil B. DeMille, the man behind The Buccaneer, Northwest Mounted Police, Samson and Delilah, and, of course, The Ten Commandments.
And as far right-wing as you can get.
And who is Mr. Staunch Anti-Communist. If you want to rebuke Carl Foreman for being nominated, you couldn't do better, and that's sort of why this movie was in there. It is an astonishingly bloated, clunky, soapbox, soapy movie about that follows a tour of Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey combined shows, as they were known back then, under the stern but fair hand of circus manager Brad Braden, played by Charlton Heston. So again, if you want to have anti-communist at the top of your movie, this is the picture to do it. And it's, you know, it's all, you know, we have Jimmy Stewart as Buttons, the clown who never takes off his makeup because it turns out he's a doctor who mercy killed his wife and has been hiding in the circus for 10 years. It's that kind of stupid.
Wow.
It's, you know, you've got this duel between, you know, trapeze artists, like who's going to get the center ring, and you've got Betty Hutton, and it's just so overwrought. And, of course, it's also immensely influential. Spielberg says that the train crash in the movie was incredibly influential to him, and it is all about big DeMille spectacle.
Well, Jim writes us at UpToDate at KCUR.org and just made that point. He says, I know Greatest Show on Earth was pretty over the top, the big top, but the train wreck, oh, man, and it was done with miniatures.
Yeah, not yet. It probably impressed the heck out of you as a kid. The miniatures really are really lousy. They're really bad. And DeMille does the narration, and it's so over the top. You know, he talks about how the circus is an army of men and machines and runs on precision and rolls over all obstacles. And it is as over the top as the circus itself. It is so hokey. And yet, it made an obscene amount of money for the time. It made, I mean, adjusted for inflation, something north of $300 or $400 million. It was a spectacular success. And it was, and DeMille, of course, was Mr. Staunch Anti-Communist. And so it's a way to kind of look back and honor his career, but also to rebuke Foreman and say, you know what? You're lucky to be here. And that's the only way that Gary Cooper could win Best Actor for playing Marshal Will Kane was by backing off of his support of Foreman. That's the kind of climate that this movie, the only possible way that the Greatest Show on Earth could have won Best Picture.
What is the clip we have here?
This is an awesome, awesome clip. This is Holly, who is the trapeze artist and who is Brad Braden's girlfriend. Brad, who has sawdust in his veins instead of blood, is telling her that he has to give the center ring over to the great Sebastian, their new high-flying, high-profile trapeze artist. And she's sort of bucking up and saying she'll do it for him because she loves him.
Pigeon, look. You're the best trapeze act in the show.
Then why don't you leave me in center?
Because Sebastian's a bigger draw.
Oh, Brad, I'll draw them. Leave me there.
Sebastian, sure. You're a chance.
You don't take chances with the show, do you?
No.
All right. I'll move over. Where do I go?
Ring one.
Oh, Brad, I do my act in Clown Alley or the horse top for you. I'd do anything if it was just for you.
Pigeon, look, out under the sky, you know how I feel about you. But under the big top, one performer's just like another to me.
You've got nothing but sawdust in your veins.
I've scraped too many of you kinkers up from the sawdust to let anybody get under my skin.
Just so the show rolls. You don't care who it rolls over, who it hurts. So it rolls over me. Be careful someday it doesn't roll over you.
I mean,
wow. That's from Greatest Show on Earth. Again, we're talking with our DVD gurus today, Mitch Brien and Jason Heck, about films that failed to win the Best Picture Academy Award that should have won it, and which films that won it that shouldn't have. 816-235-2888. Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning. You there, Al? Let's go to Roland from Independence. Roland, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to correct a misconception you had about Cavalcade.
Oh.
It's not a musical.
Okay.
It was based on a Noel Coward stage play.
Oh, that's right. And I did read that. And the play was, yeah, I you know what? I did know that in the back of my head.
It was an epic stage production, and then they basically just turned it into a film. Lots of vignettes, lots of mini scenes. It told about 40 years of English history.
Pretty good, you think?
I like it.
Okay. You know, Mitch and I will probably dig it up and give it a try on one of our movie nights then. Thank you for the correction. I knew that in the back of my head from recent Oscar research, and I totally flubbed it.
Well, wow. It's okay. I'm an old Coward fan.
Roland, thank you.
You're welcome.
So Mitch and Jason get together and have movie nights together?
Well, not...
Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, Mitch has an awesome man cave, and we've been known to sit out to watch highbrow things and end up watching some pretty lowbrow things.
Nick writes us this on Twitter. Shakespeare in Love beating Saving Private Ryan, mm-hmm. The Thin mm-hmm. Red Line, and Life is Beautiful mm-hmm. in 1998. Is Hollywood falling asleep?
No, that is what Mitch, I think, is probably going to talk about, but that was the beginning of the Weinstein marketing super machine.
Chris Overland Park writes, films with star ensemble cast like Crash seem to do well at the Oscars. Same is true with films that seem to be self-conscious of their Hollywood roots. Altman films, for instance, like The Player, are popular with the Academy.
But they don't win Best Picture. They get nominated.
But I do think Hollywood is mm-hmm. self-congratulatory. That's absolutely good. And I think ever since Grand Hotel, which is a terrific picture from the mid-30s, this idea of populating your movie with a whole bunch of movie stars mm-hmm. couldn't hurt when it comes to award time.
Sergio writes, I believe that Brokeback Mountain should have won the Oscar. The acting, cinematography, music, and script were just top-notch and deserved the Oscar. That was a major snub, in my opinion, mm-hmm. for a film that at the time was obviously controversial right. given its themes about gays.
And generally, the idea of the Academy is to stay away from the controversial stuff.
So that might have played against
Brokeback Mountain. Unless it's 10 years later and everybody knows that it's not dangerous anymore to go close to it, and then they're okay.
That would be Crash. Or Philadelphia.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Mitch, Brian, let's move on to 1994.
So 1994 was the year that the Shawshank Redemption, Quiz Show, Pulp Fiction, Four Weddings and a Funeral were all nominated.
Wow.
And Forrest Gump won. And I know that a lot of people like Forrest Gump.
I like Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump, which is the story of this naive, slow-witted young boy who becomes this great athlete and has all of these chance encounters with all of these pivotal people from the history of the 20th century.
Right.
Again, a technological innovation allowing them to put Tom Hanks in the same frame as John F. Kennedy, for example.
Right. That's what I was
thinking. So again,
of,
it's that trend towards recognizing the technological achievements of a movie. Pauline Kael, the great film critic, said simply, "I hated it thoroughly," and I
really?
Tend to agree with her. For me,
why?
Well, I think it's so sentimental, and Hollywood is always like these sentimental movies. I find it cloyingly sentimental. I find it so simplistic. And then it's also so long, and ponderous, and kind of takes itself so seriously.
But it was different, though. It was different. It was different,
but
it
not
worked.
As different
it
as
hangs Pulp. With you.
I would argue that Shawshank Redemption and Quiz
well,
Show.
Well, Shawshank Redemption is
and Pulp Fiction
an
are all
amazing film.
Pretty amazing movies. Yeah. Pulp Fiction being probably the most influential of all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But it does speak to something that's really interesting in Hollywood, which is actors love to portray – I suppose the perfect would be an actor with a disability who's a southerner and an alcoholic would be like the perfect trifecta for an actor performance. And instead of playing a clip from Forrest Gump, I would like to switch it up and recognize Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder, who has this extraordinary scene where he explains to Ben Stiller's character, who has just made a terrible bomb at the box office, a movie called Simple Jack. He's going to explain to him how the Academy Awards really work in terms of winning a Best Acting Oscar.
Okay.
About what? You're serious? You don't know? Everybody knows you never go full retard.
What do you mean?
Check it out. Dustin Hoffman, Ray Man, look retarded, act retarded. Not retarded. Count two picks, cheat of cards. Autistic. Sure. Not retarded. You got Tom Hanks, Forrest Gump. Slow, yes, retarded, maybe. Braces on his legs. But he charmed the pants off next to him and won a ping pong competition. That ain't retarded. And he was a damn war hero. Right. You know any retarded war heroes? You went full retard, man. Never go full retard. You don't buy that? Ask Sean Penn, 2001, I am Sam. Remember? Went full retard. Went home empty-handed.
That's Robert Downey.
That's Robert Downey Jr., yeah. Playing an Australian method actor who's so committed to his role that he has an operation to turn his skin black so he can play an African-American Vietnam warrior.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great. If you haven't seen Tropic Thunder, you should see it. It's hilarious.
So there's the explanation.
There's the explanation. That's why. That's
why Jodie Foster went home empty-handed for Nell.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't. There's.
You go all the way. It makes people uncomfortable. You got to have that. You got to have that little fantasy. Some magic.
Cynical.
And his point was Forrest Gump did not go all the way.
Forrest Gump did not go all the way, and that's why he won. That's why he won. That's why it's a winner.
Yeah. So very cynical that, plotting, but probably
so therein, therein is my comment on Forrest Gump.
Okay. There you go.
Harsh it's dose of truth.
816-235-2888 is our phone number. We're looking for your nominations, your recommendations for films that should have won the Best Picture Academy Award and didn't, and films that did win it and definitely should not have. Again, 816-235-2888, or drop us an email to updatedate@kcur.org. Jim from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks, Jim.
Hey, I'd like to say Saving Private Ryan. I know you said it before, but I was shocked when it didn't win Best Picture.
Yeah, that's a split that I'm going to be actually talking about a little bit in my next movie that I talk about. But that is the Miramax marketing Goliath at full throttle. That was Harvey Weinstein convincing everyone that he had this wonderful literate script by Tom Stoppard, I believe, who wrote it, and that Gwyneth Paltrow's performance was luminous and game-changing. And guess what? You tell people that enough, and as Robert Downey Jr. says in Natural Born Killers, repetition works. Repetition works. Repetition works. And so you pound that message home in the trades and at every big event you go to, and guess what? You start to sway people.
Yeah, I love that segment that you guys had from Tropic Thunder. Who was up for Golden Globe for The Wrestler? Who won Gold?
Mickey Rourke.
What's his name?
Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, Mickey Rourke. When he was up there accepting his Golden Globe, he kind of unraveled Sean Penn's secret that, you know, he's not the aloof Hollywood artist who hates the industry as he likes to portray, but, you know, he's a game player. And he knows how to win an Oscar. And, it just goes to that, 2000 I Am Sam thing right, where he came up empty-handed.
At some point, there will be a terrific web podcast called Straight Talk with Mickey Rourke that will actually probably be the most entertaining thing on the Internet. It'll be great.
Jim, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Jason Heck, let's move on to the year 1996.
96. Okay, so let's jump back real quick to 94. We have Pulp Fiction, which is backed, I believe, by Miramax. And Harvey Weinstein watches a game-changing motion picture, which Pulp Fiction most certainly was. It was an astonishing, and it's still Tarantino's best film, in my opinion. But he watched as Gump, a very traditional hidebound movie, walked away. And he vowed he would never, ever make that mistake again. So Weinstein began basically engineering movies that were Oscar bait. And it started then, and it honestly, look back at your King's Speech, and that is the King's Speech. Someone actually wrote down the perfect elements of a Weinstein Oscar picture. And basically it is you have a period piece with British royalty featuring acting royalty, in this case Colin Firth and Helena Bonham Carter, literary-minded script, tasteful direction by Tom Hooper, wartime peril, and a minor disability for your protagonist. Huh. There you go.
Uh-huh.
Cha-ching. So in 1996, we have a pretty good race, actually. We have Fargo. We have Jerry Maguire. We have Secrets and Lies. We have Shine. And we have The English Patient, which walks away with 9 golden statues.
Mm.
9. The English Patient is ponderous. It is absolutely bloated and gassy with its own self-importance.
And it won Best Picture.
It won Best Picture. Mm-hmm. And it is such a poser of a film. It wants to be David Lean, and it is not. And it has basically a Nazi for a protagonist and at the end of the film, he's basically the message of the film is kind of, if you kill a few people and the end justifies the means, so be it. You know, there is no torrent of tidal wave romance that sweeps our two lovers along in this. Ralph Fiennes and Kristin Scott Thomas, who are both superb thespians in their own right. There isn't really any chemistry there. And so, you know, say what you want about something like Moulin Rouge or something, but at least the impression that love is this impossible, there is this tidal wave sweeping everything along, is there.
That's why they have that B plot with the other two characters.
Right. And
it's more romantically satisfying.
Right, yeah. To a certain extent, but it's still not really an entertaining movie to me. And yet it did pull it off. So I'll tell you, why don't we play a clip from what I absolutely think should have won.
All right.
Oh, jeez. Here's the second one. It's in the head and the hand there. I guess that's a defensive wound.
Oh, yeah?
Where's the state trooper?
Back there, a good piece, in the ditch next to his prowler.
Okay. So we got a trooper pull someone over. We got a shooting. These folks drive by. There's a high-speed pursuit. Ends here, and then this execution-type deal.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if our suspect was from Brainerd.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, from his footprint, he looks like a big fella.
You see something down there, Chief?
No, I just think I'm gonna barf.
And that, of course, is Fargo.
That is Fargo, which had...
And those accents are, you know, those things are pretty spot on. Having lived up there, and I miss it up there.
It was a movie that was beautiful to look at. It was dark. It was, in some way, our protagonist was incredibly uplifting. This sort of Prego police chief who unravels this awful, shaky, falling apart criminal conspiracy. And, of course, you had the greatest snub in recent memory for me. You had Bill Macy as Jerry Lundegaard losing to Cuba Gooding Jr. in Jerry Maguire.
Show me the money.
Right. And, yeah. I would argue that Bill Macy's performance is one for the ages in that movie. He is so tortured. He's trying to do the right thing. He's in over his head in terms of money. And, the only way he sees out is to have his wife kidnapped and everything goes wrong. And Fargo absolutely was the best picture of 96. And the Coens had to wait until 06 to win with No Country for Old Men, which probably – or 08, I guess, which probably shouldn't have won when it was up against There Will Be Blood. But, yeah, that 96 is – again, this example of the Miramax marketing machine swinging into full power, and that's why The English Patient wins. That's why Shakespeare in Love pulls it off. That's why Chicago wins in 02. And to a certain extent, The King's Speech, which is the nice safe pick, wins in 2011, when where it probably should have gone was The Social Network, which was a very forward-looking movie.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, Mitch Bryan, let's go to the final film on our list today, final year. 2005 you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, 2005 was the year that we had Good Night and Good Luck, Munich, Capote, Brokeback Mountain, the winner was Crash.
Mm.
And Crash is to me like everything that is bad about a Best Picture winner, in that it is it's a bad movie to begin with. I mean, it was written by a guy named Paul Haggis, who I think had enough, a Canadian guy who had probably had enough of writing for Charles in Charge and other sitcoms, and decided he was going to put it all out there and tell the real truth about life in Los Angeles in the wake of him having his Porsche carjacked on Wilshire Boulevard. Now, just from the start, he should have just said my car, but he's on record as saying it was my Porsche. And that gives you a slight indication of the level of his understanding of Los Angeles. He's living in this insular television network world, and he's going to write this movie about race in L.A. And what you get is this ensemble movie with lots of movie stars, so we're back to that pattern again.
Right.
All of whom, whether it's Chris Ludacris Bridges as an African-American criminal or Matt Dillon as a racist cop, everybody sounds exactly the same. They all make speeches. They all sound like the voice of a white Canadian guy who got his Porsche car jacked and is going to tell us all about, the humanity of living in Los Angeles. Now, on one hand, I could buy that if it's some great metaphor for life in L.A., but it isn't life in L.A. because there's only like 9 people and they keep running into each other on these empty streets of Los Angeles, a city of, 10 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a question of just the credibility of it, so to take the fact that everybody sounds the same, and then that it opts for some of the most melodramatic, manipulative tricks. There's a gag involving a Persian shop owner who has had it up to here and gets a gun and goes to take revenge on a guy who wouldn't fix his door and accidentally seems to shoot his little girl. But there's just blanks in the gun, folks. It's okay. But that's only after we've milked it for all of the miscinemas possible.
What's the clip we got here?
So here's a case of Matt Dillon, who plays a racist cop going in to advocate for his father's health care, finds himself facing across the table an African-American administrator, and they both make their speeches about life in L.A.
My father doesn't deserve to suffer like this. He was a janitor. He struggled his whole life, saved enough to start his own company. 23 employees, all of them black, paid him equal wages when no one else was doing that. For 30 years, he worked side by side with those men, sweeping and carrying garbage. And then the city council decides to give minority-owned companies preference in city contracts. And overnight, my father loses everything. His business, his home, his wife, everything. But not once does he blame you people. And I'm not asking you to help me. I'm asking that you do this small thing for a man who lost everything so people like yourself could reap the benefits. And do you know what it's going to cost you? Nothing. Just a flick of your pen.
Your father sounds like a good man. And if he'd come in here today, I probably would have approved this request. But he didn't come in. You did. And for his sake, it's a real shame. Get him the hell out of my office.
Well, what an interesting show this has been. Films that won Best Oscar that shouldn't have, and just the vice versa as well. Mitch Bryan, Jason Heck, thank you both for coming in.
See you next
great
time.
Great conversation today. Sorry we couldn't get to all our phone calls. Ted from Cameron wanted to call in to say Forrest Gump deserved the award for Best Picture. Lee writes in that Forrest Gump was way over the top. So lots of divided opinions here as we go on. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.